Welcome to KDNK's Weekly Newsreel,
a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. The weekly newsreel is underwritten by RJ Paddywhack's Pet Outfitters, next to City Market in Elgibel, open 7 days a week. More info at 970-963-1700 or rjpaddywhacks.com.
I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. A two-vehicle crash near Silt Sunday resulted in three deaths. The Garfield County coroner said Tuesday that two pickup trucks collided head-on and were engulfed in flames. The impact from the crash and the fire hindered investigators from identifying the deceased. The coroner's office is working with families on forensic identification. An autopsy was scheduled for Wednesday. No further information is available.
Garfield County commissioners have allocated an additional $500,000 towards efforts to sway oil and gas rulemaking. The Post-Independent reports the board voted unanimously Monday to spend the money. Since 2019, the commissioners have put a total of $1.5 million with a Denver-based law firm to address rules passed by the Air Quality Control Commission in December. Commissioner Tom Jankowski says the effort could help maintain tax revenues generated through energy development. We'll get more updates on this story in future newscasts.
A new study explores why recent protests against racism and police brutality don't seem to have led to spikes in new coronavirus cases. A research team studied case counts for COVID-19 and cell phone data tracking people's movements. They looked at roughly 300 cities, most of which saw protests but didn't see a big rise in cases. CU Denver professor Andrew Friedson is one of those researchers. He says the protests brought a lot of people out, but they also kept a lot of people home.
If you have one large event and at the same time, everyone else, right, this is a large event, 10,000, 20,000 people, but you have another 1, 2, 3 million who are staying home, that can be enough to offset each other.
The working paper was published by the National Bureau of Economic Research. It has not yet been peer reviewed.
Wear a damn mask was Governor Jared Polis's message yesterday in Denver while giving an update on the state's response to COVID-19. Polis said the state can do better at social distancing, hand hygiene, wearing masks, and not partying. He also signed a new executive order to begin the next reopening phase. Garfield County reports 72 new COVID cases since June 22nd and three deaths since the pandemic began. The northwestern part of the state, including Garfield County, is one of three areas in Colorado with the highest COVID-19 incidence rate. On July 1st, the Lake County School District welcomed Dr. Bethany Massey as the new superintendent, reports Leadville Today. Dr. Wendy Wyman left at the end of May after 8 years as superintendent. The district is still working out a plan for the upcoming school year.
The Pickens County Board of Health Thursday extended the current public health order for 30 days. The Aspen Times reports that there are some revisions. Restaurant customers not from the same family group must personally remain 6 feet from other patrons. Group size remains capped at 50. Restaurants remain at 50% capacity and bars remain closed. The board also passed a motion urging area municipalities to increase mask-wearing enforcement.
Aurora officials will hire an independent team to investigate the death of Elijah McClain in police custody. Nine News reports the decision comes after it was found the current investigator advertised his services defending police chiefs. Plus, officials say the job of looking into the case is too big for one person. The team will determine whether or not police or first responders violated city policies, not if the officers should face charges. The Colorado Attorney General is also investigating.
Motorists can expect overnight closures in the Eisenhower-Johnson Memorial Tunnel from Sunday, July 12th through Thursday, July 16th. So the Colorado Department of Transportation can test the fire suppression system. On Sunday, one lane of westbound I-70 traffic will be closed from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. On Monday, the entire westbound bore of the tunnel will close from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. Traffic will use the eastbound bore with a pilot car and traffic signals.
Carbondale's historic Crystal Theater has yet to reopen since the onset of COVID-19. But owners Kathy and Bob Ezra are staying in touch with patrons in creative ways. Here's more from KDNK's Kathleen Shannon.
Tell me about the ways you are open right now.
Well, we're doing walk-up concessions right now on Friday and Saturday.
From 6:30 to 8, we've been offering virtual screenings that people can access through either our website, email, or Facebook. And it's basically a link that takes you to a movie that we are partnering with a studio where we share the proceeds 50-50. And it's just a way to be able to offer something and kind of stay in touch with our patrons who we miss. You know, it's kind of a flip scenario where usually we submit a box office and, you know, film payments to a company, and now they're going to be sending that stuff to us instead.
Tell me a little about the plans you have in place in the event that you do reopen.
Our capacity would be 31.
From 125.
In order to maintain 6 foot. And the way we have it laid out is in pairs of twos. You know, you got an aisle seat and then the next two in from each aisle. And then you skip a row and then the same thing. You know, we have a friend came up with these plastic seat covers so that, you know, you can remove them. Because that was an issue. How do you disinfect
fabric
seats without ruining them? You know, so we've taken the fabric inserts out of the arms so that we could clean them more easily. And we got the plexiglass shield and the concession.
And the sanitizer and the wipes and the social distance mark in the lobby, which the lobby's small anyway, so we'll probably be doing one customer at a time, which is okay with with such a low number, everybody will be fine.
It's challenging, though. I mean, really, you know, technically you should sit with a mask if you're sitting in a room for 2 hours, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how that works, how you eat concessions. You know, there's a... It's got the industry stumped. It really does.
Does that feel like it would be financially viable if people showed up in those numbers?
It's barely worth it.
Mm-hmm.
It's what, you know,
every business has to decide what's best for them and what works for them. And, you know, we're no different in that regard, except that we're an indoor business, keeping people indoors for a couple of hours.
The other problem is nothing to play. And as a result, people are playing repertory films. Apparently, Goonies has been the big hit in all the, you know, in all the repertory movies that theaters around the country that are open have been playing.
Since these are repertory titles, no one's reporting any box office numbers, so there's really no way to know how theaters are doing.
You know, this is another one of those crises. You know, you had television, and you had VCR, and then you had the internet and streaming and. And all those things were said to be the, you know,
the death knell.
Right, movie houses. Now, this that's happening is carrying a lot of that stuff, too, because some of the studios are releasing to streaming movies that they would have put in theaters. But when it all the dust settles, the question is, you know, what impact is the streaming model going to have? And maybe the studios are going to say, hey, this worked pretty good for us. Let's just keep doing it. And then the theaters suffer a little more.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Stay tuned. I mean, we're not going anywhere. We're just trying to ride this out. We had family here recently for the first time since this started, and we actually watched a Blu-ray in the theater. And, I mean, you just sit there, and it just...
Still works.
Like, wow, yeah, this is where I want to be. This is what I want to be doing, and there's nothing like it.
Man, the experience when a whole crowd gasps or cries or laughs, it's just really not the same on Netflix.
The best. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just the best. Even if we're only hearing 31 people laugh, it's still good.
On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked construction of parts of the Keystone XL pipeline. The Dakota Access Pipeline, subject of extensive protests, was also ordered to shut down Monday and emptied of oil pending an environmental review. And two major utilities canceled the Atlantic Coast Pipeline that would have transported natural gas across the Appalachian Trail into Virginia and North Carolina. But in Oregon, landowners and activists are still fighting the Jordan Cove project. According to From the Sticks blog, the U.S. Department of Energy also on Monday gave the green light for liquefied natural gas exports from the proposed Jordan Cove terminal in Coos Bay. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission approved the Jordan Cove LNG facility and the 235-mile Pacific Connector pipeline in March, but the project still needs several permits from Oregon state agencies to move forward. So this week, a group of Oregon landowners who could lose land because of the pipeline filed a motion asking the D.C. Circuit Court to invalidate FERC's approval. The motion argues that FERC violated the Natural Gas Act by approving the pipeline. The landowners also asked the court to immediately stay or pause proceedings and prevent Pembina, owner of the pipeline project, from seizing their properties until the case is resolved.
On Wednesday, The Nation magazine hosted a forum of Native American leaders who have been fighting the pipeline for years. In this clip, Indigenous youth leader Takata Iron Eyes, a member of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, shares her response to the decision.
So I was 11 years old when I started being vocal about my opposition and my people's opposition of the Dakota Access Pipeline. I was 11. I am now 16 years old, and for a long time, I never expected in the first place to have Standing Rock be such a monumental sort of platform for Indigenous peoples and Indigenous people. I think that it allowed sort of space in mainstream media for people to finally hear, you know, what's been happening. Who are Native people in the Americas and all across the globe? Who are these people who have been protecting 80% of the world's biodiversity for millennia? Who are the first peoples of the places that we live in? For me, this really has been such a huge sign that people are becoming more and more receptive to those messages. We know now that we must treat Indigenous peoples as human beings because Indigenous rights are human rights. No one should have to fight for clean water. And these are all things that, you know, this younger generation of people, this Gen Z, they understand that. They get it. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, it's really a slap to the face of Gen X, this generation before the boomer generation. It's like your actions are unacceptable and they will not be tolerated anymore. You cannot preach something to your kids. You cannot preach kindness and compassion to your kids. You cannot preach empathy and then go into positions of leadership and make decisions and policies that negatively affect people's quality of life. That is not okay, and we will not tolerate it anymore. And so I really grew up with that movement, and it made me into who I am, and it gave me the purpose that I have today. And it really, it feels good to just know that a movement started by young people, an 11-year-old and her comrades of similar age, that movement was successful and that pipeline has been shut down. And if anything, it's a huge sign to young people everywhere that what we are doing is working and we must keep going if we want to see the change happen. If we want change to be enacted by people in power, we need to be vocal about it and we need to make sure that it happens because the power belongs in the hands of the people. And it's time that we start speaking up and realizing that we have all of that potential sitting with us. I always thought about, even when I was a kid, people understand what they need. People understand what they want. And all everyone needs is a good push in the right direction to know that they can accomplish that, that those things are possible. Because why should we have people living without clean water, living without sustainable energy? Why should we have people suffering when we know that the 1%, these billionaires, is these people with gross amounts of wealth? This sort of disparity, we know that the way that they're living, the luxury, the safety, those things are possible for every human being on this earth, and we are tired of being denied those rights. South Dakota, these states who have decided to ignore the calls of their own citizens for so long, they have another thing coming for them. As we've seen at Mount Rushmore, that front line was entirely held by young Indigenous women. And elders, that's all it is. And it's really telling your children, telling young people everywhere that you believe in them and you believe in their right to tell between right and wrong and giving them the courage to speak up about the things that they know are negatively impacting the people around them, giving them the courage to be like, you have the power in these situations to enact change. And, you know, and if the people in power aren't accepting that accountability that we are trying to hold them to, then they are not fit to hold their positions any longer.
That was Takata Iron Eyes speaking at a forum hosted by The Nation. You can hear the entire forum at thenation.com.
You're listening to the weekly news reel featuring top stories aired between Monday and Friday. In-kind support comes from Grassroots Community Network, promoting civic participation through civil discourse, creative endeavors, and cultural interaction. More info at grassrootstv.org.
Last month, locally organized Black Lives Matter demonstrations cropped up from Aspen to Parachute. Most of the events occurred without incident, but after some tense moments during a march in Rifle on June 19th, some of the town's residents feel they're being sent a clear message not to speak up. KDNK's Lucas Turner has this report.
Stephen is a Rifle resident and person of color who attended both Black Lives Matter demonstrations in Rifle last month. He says he'd like to attend future demonstrations in the area, but after experiences protesting in town, he says he doesn't feel safe or welcome. On June 2nd, after attending a candlelit vigil in Rifle in honor of George Floyd, Stephen says he was followed on his way home. Here he is speaking to Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hagee about the incident.
The truck was pacing me as I was climbing the hill and entering the neighborhood, all the while kind of waving his middle finger and yelling at me through the window.
Stephen was worried the man was carrying a gun and eventually hid behind a parked vehicle. He later told the Rifle Police Department about it. Rifle PD told the Mountain West News Bureau this was an isolated incident, but if Stephen feels threatened again, to call 911.
Stephen told KDNK that when he heard about a second protest in Rifle planned for June 19th, he was at first hesitant to attend. But he felt the issue was important enough that he put those concerns aside and joined protesters anyway. As previously reported on KDNK, motorcyclists lined up in parking lots along the path of the Black Lives Matter march, revving engines in a coordinated effort to drown out chants, and filled the sidewalk with thick exhaust fumes as protesters marched by. Stephen says he came away from that day feeling like counter-protesters and those riding motorcycles wanted to send the same message as the person who followed him home on June 2nd, to not speak up in the city of Rifle. His next step was to submit a public statement to Rifle City Council meeting on July 1st, asking the council to condemn the behavior he believes is illegal and that he describes as a pattern of escalation.
You know, the motorcycles were one specific instance, but just this attitude that if you disagree with someone politically, you can show up and make as much noise as possible, even to the point that it would cause pain and, you know, potential trauma to the children present, just because you disagree with them.
Stephen's statement asserts that the behavior of counter-protesters violated multiple municipal codes, including the noise ordinance, and disrupting a lawful assembly. He says by using noise and caustic exhaust as a weapon, motorcyclists crossed the line from free speech to breaking the law. But Stephen's statement never made it to the public comment period because Stephen says he felt uncomfortable with the submission requirements outlined by the city clerk. She told him that he would need to provide an address and a full name, and that the information would be read out loud during the meeting. Here he is reading part of the statement for this story.
Does our city condone such unilateral escalation if it is in clear violation of the Rifle Municipal Codes? What would the city say to the peaceful protesters whose hearing and breathing were compromised that day, as motorcyclists were allowed to leapfrog the peaceful demonstration from parking lot to parking lot in broad daylight, at times on city property, and in full view of police officers? How will the city demonstrate to the diverse coalition who came out that day that their rights, health, and safety will be protected in the future?
Stephen says he was willing to share his address with the city clerk to verify his residence, just that he didn't want it to be read out loud during the meeting. He also hoped to keep his last name confidential. Ultimately, Stevens' request was denied by city staff, who insisted that not only did he need to submit the information, but that it would be read out loud during the meeting. If he wouldn't agree to that, then his comment would not be read. Rifle Mayor Barb Clifton told KDNK that providing a name and address can lend weight and credibility to public comments, especially since April, when staff first started accepting comments by email due to COVID-19.
So that's been what our city clerk has told anyone who wants to now call in or email in, is that they have to give their address. And I know and some people don't even want to give their full name. That is not really the nature of public comments.
Since mid-April of 2020, Rifle City staff has received and read 4 public comments during council meetings, all of which were submitted by email. In every case, staff did read the first and last name of the person who submitted the comment, but they did not read any addresses. Looking back further, through November of 2019, those who have submitted public comments have not been required to read their addresses during the public comment period. Lou Colby also lives in Rifle and attended the protests on June 19th. She also wanted to submit a public comment, so in order to have it read, she complied with requests to submit an address. Like Stephen, Lou Colby asks the council to acknowledge and publicly condemn the alleged illegal behavior of motorcyclists and counter-protesters in Rifle on June 19th.
We do not want people to be afraid to come to Rifle, afraid that Rifle has been commandeered by radicalized forces fomenting animosity, dehumanization, disenfranchisement, and bullying of persons not adhering to their beliefs. Thank you for the opportunity to express my concern.
That's Rifle City Manager Scott Hahn reading Lou Colby's comment. He begins by making sure to read her address out loud into the record. The sound ends with City Council moving on to the consent agenda. Colby's comment is not addressed.
Okay. Well, thank you for that comment. The next item, consent agenda. Consider approving.
All comments submitted by email prior to July 1st also received acknowledgement from the mayor, council, or staff during the meeting. Mayor Barb Clifton says the council doesn't usually make statements condemning behavior of people in the city. Instead, she suggests some alternative ways citizens can make their voices heard.
You can certainly meet with our city manager if you have some concerns about the way, you know, the town's being run. You can certainly meet with our police chief. Uh-huh. If you have concerns, which I think were more his concerns, and talk about what happened and why and what he feels, you know, needs to happen. Those are all options for people. There are a lot of options to get your comments to us if you are not comfortable stating your name and where you live. So
Mayor Clifton also says she understands why in situations like this, people might be hesitant to provide an address, and says that City Council will discuss the subject during their next meeting.
I think people will need to say whether they live in the city limits or not, and maybe just give their address to the clerk, you know, but not have it part of the public record.
Right.
We're going to discuss that at the next meeting, because I do get that.
The mayor of Rifle also reached out personally to Stephen, who sent his comment directly to City Council members.
I mean, I respect the mayor taking the time to do that, but I still think that more needs to be done to make people feel comfortable raising their voices in Rifle.
Rifle Mayor Barb Clifton says council and staff are willing to meet with anyone, whether they'd like to submit comments publicly or privately. You can find City Council and staff contact information and view City Council meetings online at rifleco.org. KDNK News, I'm Lucas Turner.
And finally, Basalt's edible public permaculture food forest is abundant with fruits and vegetables for the taking. KDNK's Raleigh Burley shares this audio postcard from a recent planting trip with sustainable settings.
The oranger they are, the riper they are.
Ripening into its fifth season, Basalt's public food park is located just off the Basalt Avenue roundabout.
About 5 years ago, which was 1 year after we started the seed library in the Basalt Library, the town gardener at the time, Lisa DiNardo, heard a story about it on KDNK and reached out and just wanted to support that project. And at that time, I had been dreaming of a place close to the library where we could grow out seeds for the seed library.
Stephanie Sison has seen the project through since its inception.
A edible public permaculture food forest that's open to all for everyone to eat was always a dream of mine, and We presented the idea to the council, and they were just all on board. So they gave us the green light, and we've been building it ever since.
I think it's quite incredible to have this accessible to the public as a potential food source, not only to inspire local people who see it to plant some of these varieties around their own town or in their own backyards, but to actually feed some people.
And then we have the signs in Spanish with the different permaculture principles around.
Volunteer Dan Whitney was among a group of workers from Sustainable Settings transplanting annual crops into the garden beds in late June, courtesy of a donation from Seed Peace.
What kind of tree is it? Is this like a pear tree? What is this?
And the biggest users of this park are our homeless population. And that really makes an impact to people's lives.
All of these amazing plants that we're planting right now were donated by Casey Pescura from Seed Peace. He also runs Wild Mountain Seeds, amazing vegetable grower and seed breeder, and now has opened this really beautiful nonprofit called Seed Peace that is really helping out in this valley in large ways, growing food for people who need it, and here donating all of these beautiful vegetable plants that we can plant in this park so that anyone who just needs a little snack or wants a whole bunch of celery can come out and feed themselves that way.
I think we got them all.
Additionally, the garden adheres to strict ethics for the care that these plants receive.
Absolutely. There are no pesticides or herbicides here. This is a completely organic garden space for all to enjoy.
Some already little tomatoes on that plant.
There's a number of them have fruit on them already.
So where are you putting the comfrey that you're cutting?
Well, if this was a regular home garden or a farm, I would just put it right under the fruit trees. But that can look a little bit messy for a little while. So for now, we're gonna put it in the compost bins, and then it can compost and add to what we have back there. It'll make it super nutrient rich, and then we'll apply the compost back to the gardens in the fall with more mulch.
When you were like, put it into the compost pile, I was like,
what?
Really?
Just put them down.
Just chop and drop.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, it's a park.
Yeah.
People be weird.
Okay. Aesthetics are important.
Nate Greaves interns with Sustainable Settings and was surprised by the abundance at the food park.
I'm quite impressed. I've been in the area for a little over a year now, and I'm surprised that I've never been here. Just had a bunch of delicious cherries. First cherries of the season for me. Really just a treat. I wish more parks like this existed.
I think it took a few years for anyone to understand what this project is and to feel empowered to harvest from a public space, from a place that you didn't plant. As we started teaching more classes at the schools, I think that's when we really started gaining traction, because the kids would then tell their parents that it was here and tell their parents that they were allowed to eat from it. Now we have Bing cherries to eat off the tree, and nectarines and gooseberries and currants and raspberries, lots of medicinal herbs, mustard, some tomatillas, all kinds of yummy things here.
For KDNK News, I'm Raleigh Burley.
There's more to eat all the time.
That is awesome.
That does it for this week's newsreel on KDNK. All of our stories and more are at kdnk.org. The Weekly Newsreel is a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.